Hey, Peter, how are you?
I'm well, Rich. How are you? Good to talk to you again.
Yeah, nice to talk with you. You've been busy. I feel like it was just 7 or 8 months ago we talked with you about your terrific book on REM. And by the way, love the essay you wrote for David Leaf's new book on Brian Wilson and Smile.
Oh, thank you very much.
Well, you've written about Bruce before your wonderful book from 2012, but this is such a deep dive into, I don't know, is it fair to say, the most critical turning point of his career?
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of the things that I was most interested in was remembering what it was like back in the 70s when, as a fan or somebody who was interested in his career, there was a sense for really until 1980 that it could kind of go either way for Bruce. Everybody knew, or a lot of people knew, how talented he was, what a great performer, how thrilling his shows were. But he still had such a hard time getting on the radio. Record sales were always lagging. And by the time he was getting into starting his third album in the early 1974, after his first two records had failed to connect, Columbia Records was on the verge of just canceling his contract and sending him home. They do that all the time in record companies. And he didn't really have a lot of fans at the top end of management then. And so they gave him a chance to make one last song and see if it sounded like a song that might get played on the radio, become a hit single. And at the moment, he was just starting to write this new song that he was thinking of calling Born to Run. And they spent 6 months working on that one song, trying to get it to sound just exactly right in the studio.
And there are so many people who are crucial to telling this story. And one of them is, of course, Mike Appel. Knowing what would go on between the two of them later on, it's really illuminating to go back and look at the lengths that Mike would go to help his man be successful.
Yeah, Bruce met Mike Appel in early 1972, late 1971. And at the time, he was just making the transition to the type of sort of singer-songwriter kind of folky songs that he was beginning to kind of lean into as an artist. And Mike heard those early songs and really understood the complexity of them and felt the excitement that Bruce could put into a song and really cultivated him and helped him grow and got him his first record contract at Columbia and got him a lot of attention for the first album. And just as Bruce was trying to break through and really, not being able to connect with radio or record buyers, and getting sort of rejected, left, all over the place, Mike was completely resilient and just doubled down and tripled down on supporting Bruce and forcing people to listen and pay attention and do whatever they could to help him.
And don't want to give away too much, but I love the story of Mike's Super Bowl pitch.
Yeah, well, occasionally, as they say in Spinal Tap, there's such a thin line between brilliant and stupid. And at one point, Mike, I mean, this was in the days before the Super Bowl became like this global holiday as it is now. But even in the early 1970s, it was kind of a big deal. And Mike Appel, this is before I think Bruce's first album had even come out, or maybe it was just the first two records, but he was still this kind of shaggy hippie kid from New Jersey that nobody had ever heard of. And Mike called the executive who was programming the Super Bowl coverage and said that the whole broadcast should begin with Bruce standing in the 50-yard line with his acoustic guitar singing a new original anti-war song. Which is like, they said, yeah, no, I think that's not actually what we're going to be doing. And as Mike says, it's like, though that was crazy, sure. But on the other hand, he also had this crazy idea that he could get Bruce on the cover of both Time and Newsweek. And that not only worked out, he achieved it in the same week in 1975.
This is also the time when John Landau enters the scene. He had already written that famous review of Bruce. And I thought it was interesting that Mike Appel was okay with John becoming part of it and being in there as a co-producer. I think I loved your line. You said that Bruce set his collaborators in opposition so he could pivot between them.
Yeah, you know, Bruce grew up in this family where, you know, he almost had essentially had two sets of parents, his grandparents who cared for him when he was very young because both of his parents worked, and then his actual real parents. And so Bruce would kind of toggle between these two interest groups and play them and learned from a very young age how to play them off of each other, which, as he admits now, isn't maybe the most healthy or functional way to relate to family, but on the other hand, it's a very effective way for a young boy to get what he wants. And he began to realize as he got older that he could use that same tactic when working with two different, you know, sets of advisors or influences to sort of run things by both of them and figure out which of their, you know, contrasting ideas feels, you know, most comfortable for him. And then he can sort of pick and choose and let them, you know, let the people at the opposite poles fight it out for themselves.
This was also a crucial time with some big personnel changes to what would become the E Street Band.
Mm-hmm. Bruce always wanted his band to be ethnically and racially mixed. He liked that idea of a diverse community, just, you know, the artistic, with people with different artistic influences, people with different cultural experiences, that would come together to be the most powerful unit. And heading into 1974, the E Street Band was actually evenly divided. There were three white musicians and three African-American musicians. And that was really important to him because he liked that idea. You know, unfortunately, partway through 1974, two of his African-American musicians left the band. Davey Sanchez, who was his keyboard player, got his own record deal to start a jazz fusion band, and he took the drummer Ernest Boom Carter with him. And it wasn't bitter. I mean, they just both had a new and better opportunity to do their own thing. And Bruce was, you know, it was a bittersweet parting, but it was a very, very collegial one.
The book is absolutely fabulous. Tonight in Jungle Land, The Making of Born to Run, and your conversation with Bruce about August 25th in the epilogue, man, just magical.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. It was interesting. I got to spend a bunch of time talking to him about the Born to Run era and, you know, the years working up to it. You know, and we've spoken an array of times, I mean, starting back when I was working on the biography. But this was, talking about that album was clearly a very special thing for him. I think it's a very powerful experience and so transformative for him and his career, and his, you know, his evolution as an artist. And I think also, you know, it's not an exaggeration to say it was pretty transformative in the history of American rock and roll too.
Peter, thanks as always. Congratulations on a wonderful book. Much success going forward.
Thank you so much, Rich.